UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the UEG Talks. It's Pradeep Mundra here, and I'm your host for today. This is the second part of our podcast on MAPS 3 guidelines with Professor Mario Diniz Ribeiro, full professor of the Faculty of Medicine at University of Porto, consultant gastroenterologist and head of Porto Comprehensive Cancer Center and vice director of the research center there. If you haven't listened to the first part of this episode, I urge you to do so before listening to this. This is the second part of the two-part series. So in the first part, we discussed the scope of the MAPS 3 guidelines. We discussed screening for gastric cancer and pre-malignant lesions. We also discussed population-based screening and how to become better in recognizing and describing pre-malignant lesions in that episode. So let's continue that in this second part here to come. Mario, coming on to the next statement or the other statements that come through, you made a statement on use of AI-assisted detection. Now, I have covered this in one of the other podcasts, use of AI in the upper GI tract with Alana Ebigbo. That's a much longer one. We discussed all aspects. But what was the guideline committee recommendation on use of artificial intelligence in the upper GI tract as of now? I'm sure this is an evolving field and things will change in the future.
So first of all, we had the chance to systematically review the literature a couple of years ago. And what we've shown was that most of the systems reach the expert level, defined as the chance of not missing more than 10%. And I think this is a scary feature or number that was consistently suggested that we may miss 10% of lesions seen in the stomach. And based on this, AI was kind of leveled to this level. And for detection, he or she recommended that the system should have 90% of detection rate or above. For characterization, we could accept a lower threshold of 80%, again, as experts are able to anticipate curative resection for when they see superficial lesions, and the same 90% for detecting premalignant conditions. So this threshold is, well, you can compare this with other metrics that we have in other parts of the globe for the use of virtual comendoscopy, et cetera. But for instance, are these levels of accuracy that eventually providers of AI, are we there? The studies, they say yes, but then, for instance, when we go for cost effectiveness to try to see if AI could bring to a different level the performance of gastroscopy in different countries, we would require a higher level of accuracy from the systems at a low cost. For instance, for Netherlands and for Italy, that those were the countries that we used as contrast to Portugal to show if these systems could be cost effective if they would be applied to endoscopy. So answering briefly, what we said is that if the systems that you may have in front of you are already validated and have that threshold, I think this will come to our practice. We don't want to miss a cancer when we do a gastroscopy. And we would like to have systems that eventually automatically would stage the gastritis that is in front of you and will say even, okay, you need to surveil this patient.
Yeah. Just for clarity, Mario, when you refer to AI detection, meeting expert standards, is that detection of pre-malignant lesions, or is that detection of dysplasia and cancer? Just wanted to clarify that.
They are both. Yeah, both. So there are systems that are more developed for detecting cancer. There are some studies, not that many, for detecting pre-malignant. And even in our group, we have been presenting that recently, where we were able to develop some algorithms that can establish as good as experts the staging of intestinal metaplasia in the stomach. So we will be there. Not now, but we will be there.
Yeah. Mario, I just wanted to cover a couple of points from the gastroenterologists who routinely deal with management of dysplasia and early cancer. There's a couple of things I think
they would benefit from discussing. Let's say patients have early gastric cancer, which is resectable endoscopically. The routine practice in our center is anything that's called a cancer, we do a staging CT scan. But the guideline committee seems to deviate slightly from that. I think if you just say a couple of lines about it, because that's, I think, is a bit practice changing and potentially will save a lot of resources. And I remember from my days when I was in Japan, they didn't do CT scans there. So we seem to differ in the West. Can you just say a couple of lines for the benefit of gastroenterologists who deal with these things?
Yeah, definitely. So what we suggested was that, of course, this is applicable to all the things that you do. You should have a high quality endoscopy, and you need to be sure that that lesion that is in front of you, you adequately characterized, and eventually it's enough to have the endoscopic fixture. So if you use the location, the size, the Paris classification, and in the absence of any signs of deep submucosal invasion, CT scan and US does not have to making any decision. So you should, of course, if the patient is comfortable with that, you should resect the lesion and decide afterwards. Of course, we know that we miss 20% of lesions that we may, let's say, so it's a 20% misdiagnosis when we allocate patients to treatment. But on the other side, we do know that from these, some of them will not have surgical conditions, so they were treated anyhow, and some of the others will have been missed by US, because we do know that also a misdiagnosis occurs, or misstaging occurs, when even among the best US performers. So in the absence of signs of deep submucosal invasion, chances of having the muscle appropriate also involved, there is no reason to perform further staging. And this change, of course, after the resection, where you need to stage properly the patient to manage if finally non-curative occurs. So in this setting, the guidelines does not add too much to the most recent guideline that was published before this. The effort here was just to comprehensively bring this discussion towards this field. So no major changes the readers may expect to see within the MAPS 3 guidelines.
So from the curative resection criteria compared to previous guidelines, you're keeping it pretty roughly similar. Okay.
Yeah. What we did suggest, of course, it will be very difficult, but again, coming back to your comments where we do too many endoscopies, and I completely agree. What we suggested is that there may be some groups of patients where, in the absence of further risk factors for metachronous lesions, we could release them from surveillance, or at least to do a less intensified surveillance after resection. So if there is some logic about what we are suggesting, you will have more screened people, once-in-a-lifetime screened individuals. Some of them will harbor superficial lesions, and most of them will survive. So we need probably to have also some metrics and measures not to overburden survivals that will more and more come to our services. So I do expect that we endoscopists in this field of cancer, we will transform the surveillance in a very, let's say, less invasive form of caring of patients. I will not allude non-invasive markers because they don't exist, but eventually that will come also.
Mario, the next section of discussion, which is probably most important, I want to focus on recognizing or identifying pre-malignant lesions, how to describe these things, common mistakes that are made. I think this part is extremely important for most endoscopists who don't routinely deal with gastric pre-malignant lesions or deal with resection of dysplastic lesions. Now, let's start off with a practical question. Let's say you talked about opportunistic screening. Let's say a patient comes in with dyspepsia and I'm doing an endoscopy, and I roughly know what atropy is, I know what interstellar metaplasia is, and I start seeing this. How would you approach in reporting this endoscopy, in terms of reporting this atropy and interstellar metaplasia? And what's your systematic approach towards taking the biopsies? Just, give us a brief summary. I'm sure the listeners can go through the guidelines. It's well described there.
Yeah. So first of all, don't focus too much on biopsies. and consider that you are the best morphologist at that moment. So clean the mucosa, insufflate, disinsufflate, and insufflate again, so that you see that you are sure that you didn't miss any cancer. Okay. Afterwards, I always start by looking at the antrum and the incisor quite carefully. This is the region where H. pylori related neoplasias occur more oftenly. And still, in one systematic review that we also published, one quarter of the missing cancers are there. So if you nicely see that region, and if you take time, well, most of the scope providers nowadays, they have systems of virtual chromatoscopy, and you can either start by white light and move to virtual chromatoscopy and get back to white light back and forth. But then with that process, you also learn how to recognize these changes even with white light. Then I moved upwards and do the same process. Looking at the antrum and in the incisura and the lesser curvature, you can recognize trophic changes by a pale mucosa that is whitish, and eventually with some line that separates these two compartments differently from the anatomic compartment that is the incisura. So if you see that line in the antrum and in incisura, probably this patient has atrophic changes in the antrum. It may or may not have intestinal metaplasia. And the same goes to the corpus that is less frequent. And of course, I will not allude now to autoimmune gastritis, that it's the other way around. You can anticipate these changes most often in the corpus. When we touch the button to use virtual chromatoscopy, then you may see areas that you may recognize as intestinal metaplasia. Bluish areas, some tubulus villus pattern. You may see a light blue crest that is a very, very nice signal that once you see it, you never forget it. And you may measure or anticipate the extension of these changes. So in terms of report, what I do is I say, I didn't see any superficial lesion in the fundus, in the corpus, in the incisura, and in the antrum. I recognize atrophic changes by endoscopy only in the antrum, in the antrum incisura, or affecting the entire antrum and corpus. And I do recognize some changes of intestinal metaplasia, again, in the antrum, incisura, and or in the corpus. After that, if I do recognize intestinal metaplasia, I tend to target the biopsies to those areas. But we should always do two biopsies in the antrum, in the lesser curvature and the greater curvature, and two in the corpus, and send these two pairs separately for pathologists. There is a lot of discussions if we need the biopsy from the incisura. There is a lot of discussion if we need to send separately these jars also to save the environment to pathologists. But at least for now, for most clinicians, take care of the corpus, take care of the stomach separately, and report separately these morphological findings and send separately the biopsies to the pathologist, at least in the very first endoscopy. During surveillance, with the evidence that exists, you may drop the need for biopsies if you don't care again to screen for H. pylori. So if you screen a patient when it's 50 and you have that patient again with 62, you may wonder if you want again to know if he's H. pylori infected. But without the absence of superficial lesions and in the absence of you and the patient wishing to know for some reason infection for H. pylori, once you establish the phenotype, surveil that patient if it is to be surveilled without biopsies.
So in summary, Mario, it's important for the endoscopist to describe whether they found atrophy and then describe whether it's present in the antrum, whether it's extending into the incisura, and whether it's extending into the body, and similarly recognize intestinal metaplasia, describe the extent of it, whether restricted to the antrum, going up to the body, and subdivision, they can always say it's kind of in the anterior, you know, how extensively it's extending, and then take biopsies. And you've left out the biopsy from the incisura. Previous guidelines were recommending that's no longer required. And you said that it's just two biopsies from the antrum, two biopsies from the body. Why did you leave out incisura biopsies anymore in the new guidelines?
Yeah, again, it's not left out. It became optional because there are three moments in the story, in the history of this suggestion of assessing both compartments. First, the first descriptions were only with 2+2 biopsies. Then the modified Sydney-Houston system included cases of biopsy because that can be eventually the line where most consistently changes occur and also H. pylori can be found. But and then, of course, the systems for staging atrophic and intestinal metaplasia use that incisura biopsy in the incisura, and then the maps came again suggesting only 2+2. So there was some confusion, and recently also in another consensus, regained consensus, that also challenged everyone to read, led by Professor Ruge, there was some consensus on dropping as mandatory the biopsy in the incisura because it doesn't add the number needed to biopsy. It was considered to be very high to add information. Of course, for those that in clinical practice they want to continue to include and send in the same jar as the antrum, that's fine, as long as they don't separate in a different jar, because then it's the environment that it's affected. There was an argument that I was sensitive to recently that was some suggested that for making the biopsy in the incisura, you would take more time looking at incisura. Maybe that's reasonable, but there is no evidence to suggest that. So what I said in that lecture that someone, let's say, posed this argument was that we need more research in this field to show definitely if we need or not the incisura biopsy. So for those that continue to do it, they are not against the guidelines. For those that don't want to do it, they want to look carefully and use endoscopic staging rather than making a further biopsy, another biopsy, that's fine also. Don't focus too much on biopsies. That's, I think, also a nice message because it's you trust your eyes, learn how to scope, learn how to recognize, and the biopsies will further help. It's the same process as you were first and before alluding to US and CT scans for lesions that we do consider that we will treat them in this case. And this is in the West because in the East, for ages, they don't do biopsies to assess atrophic changes then. And intestinal metaplasia, so they trust their eyes and they stage endoscopically the stomach.
Yeah, that's one thing I've seen which is different. So Mario, let's say I've got the endoscopy description, I've got exactly the extent, and then I have the histology results. There's a bit of complex grid that the guideline has recommended in terms of deciding what qualify for surveillance and who do not qualify for surveillance. And we can follow that. Is there a simpler way to summarizing the whole thing? You know, one golden rule, let's say, who needs to be surveyed and who doesn't need to be surveyed?
Yeah. So most individuals will not require surveillance. So most will have what we can call almost normal changes of minor atrophic changes in the antrum and some scattered spots of intestinal metaplasia. So for those individuals, we do not recommend surveillance with the exception of having some family history in their families. Again, neither the country or ethnicity seems to affect the surveillance rate. Okay, eventually, if we come back to a screening program, again, as I said before, if these individuals come for a gastroscopy and he has or he belongs to a specific ethnicity, he may return to the screening protocol. For a subset of patients, it varies from subgroup to country, so it correlates with the risk of gastric cancer. But to a subgroup that is estimated between 3 and 5%, 10% in the high-risk countries, we may have to surveil these patients every 3 years. Those patients with extensive intestinal metaplasia. But don't mix up here the extensive intestinal metaplasia that sometimes you see in the reports of pathologists that refers to a specific site. It's again the report of endoscopy that you've done saying, I do see atrophic changes in the antrum, incisura, and corpus with a lot of changes that I recognize of intestinal metaplasia, both in the antrum and both in the corpus. And eventually, even if you don't see them, if you have a report from pathology reporting intestinal metaplasia in both compartments, you should surveil these patients. This is an easy rule of thumb to surveil patients.
Yeah, that's not very nicely simplified, Mario. Because often I think, you know, the endoscopist may report, oh, there's just changes in the antrum. The pathologist says, listen, I've seen intestinal metaplasia in the body or corpus. and you take the worst of the devil. You take what's the worst grading, so to say, because, you know, the endoscopist must have missed something, or histopathologist may have missed.
Yeah, that's why in the guideline we also present a table.
Very nice, yeah.
Or a picture where we correlate both concepts, because there is actually, when you speak about false negatives or false positives of these endoscopic markers, it's also, you need to consider that the multifocality of these changes may lead to, let's say, someone not finding an endoscopic finding that you described just because you missed the spot where you did the biopsy, or the other way around. So, and also, pathologists are not that reliable when they assess atrophy, and that's why we didn't do that step about suggesting to use only intestinal metaplasia, but there is a sentence there in the text. We suggest intestinal metaplasia should be the most reliable marker. And again, you eventually further select the patients only for a subset of patients to be surveilled. Again, the concern is, again, yes, you should do gastroscopy. Yes, you should do it properly. Yes, you should not miss a cancer. You should use all the technologies that you have in front of you to not miss anyone. But then, please, please, please take care only of those that merit surveillance, because there is evidence to suggest that those are the ones at risk. It's not a very strong evidence, but it's consistent. It's consistent to say, and it's the best marker we have. I would say that what I expect is that the schedule in 3 years will probably be even that too often, or too intensive, because we saw that for the polyps in the colon, we saw that for Barrett. So the more we learn with this, probably in a few years we will say, okay, there is another marker that we should use much better than using these atrophic changes.
Okay, so the most important thing is endoscopic description by the endoscopist and histopathological interpretation. A good histopathologist saying things, and you combine those and come up with whether the patient needs surveillance or not. Now, Mario, what are the common mistakes that you come across in clinical practice in terms of assignment of surveillance? You may have come across, I've got some examples, but you come across more of these. Can you explain to us what we can learn from where we get things wrong?
Yeah. So when we already discussed is not stopping surveillance, I think it's something that we see often, because again we have an aging population. Secondly, I think we continue to see patients that do have intestinal metaplasia, but only mild changes in the antrum, and those should not be surveilled. And yeah, on the other side, eventually, for some reason that, let's say, we don't, and again, we observe that also in other, let's say, areas, in other diseases, again, such as Barrett, that is to over-surveil patients with extensive intestinal metaplasia. So sometimes I see both sides of the coin. And living in Portugal, I tend to see over-surveillance more than under-surveillance. But I also anticipate that this is seen in other countries the other way around, saying, okay, oh, I have a patient that does not come from a specific ethnicity, does not come from a specific country. Even though there is intestinal metaplasia everywhere, I will not surveil this patient. This is probably, it may lead to a missed opportunity for prevention.
Yeah. I can tell you where I stand within the UK. Now, I think we have a tendency to undercall. We have a tendency to not diagnose patients. And we have tendency to under-survey rather than over. I think that's the way, that's the trend I tend to see locally. So, coming on to the next sort of discussion, can you briefly discuss about any risk factors? We know the Helicobacter pylori is the main risk factor in most gastric cancers or intestinal type related to that. What are the other risk factors that we need to be aware of?
Well, again, we focused here in, again, gastric cancer related with H. pylori, but of course, in the stomach, we also have the upper part that may have other factors, but it's quite consistent, the role of smoking. So in all the patients, you should suggest stop smoking, specifically in these patients. It's not unfrequent that patients are very, let's say, concerned about cancer, but they do smoke. And there is some evidence also suggesting the alcohol effect. Again, we are, let's say, less intensively suggesting to moderate the consumption of alcohol. There may be a role for protective factors rather than risk factors. Beyond aspirin, we could not suggest any other potentially medication that could be of benefit for these patients. Even for aspirin, we suggested that for those at the high risk of having cardiovascular diseases that may coincide in terms of age for this disease. So stop smoking, eradicate H. pylori, and eventually ingest more antioxidants.
So in terms of eradication of H. pylori, does it have a benefit once patients have already developed these premalignant changes, or even, let's say, patients already have dysplastic changes or even early gastric cancer? Let's say patients are found to have Helicobacter pylori positive. Would that benefit at that stage when you've gone to a stage of chronic changes?
Yeah. So starting from the end, if you do have a patient with an early gastric cancer, you need to eradicate H. pylori because it's a risk factor for having further lesions during surveillance. If you detect a patient with H. pylori with no lesions, this is the best moment to eradicate H. pylori because then you, let's say, delete the risk factor, or you abolish the risk factor for all the cascade. And there is some discrepancy in the data about further stages and the effect of H. pylori. It's quite consistent on some effect in the atrophic. When there is some atrophic changes, there is some controversy when there is established intestinal hyperplasia, the so-called point of no return. We need to revisit all this literature because most of that was based on old endoscopies, random biopsies with a multifocality of these processes. And there is a strong data suggesting that H. pylori, even at an old age, has an effect in reducing the risk. Why do I speak about the old age? Because it leads also to significant atrophic changes in intestinal hyperplasia. So probably if you have H. pylori, even though if it doesn't regress, it may hold on the process, even if you don't observe it, because it may take a while to observe that long-term effect of eradication. So eradicate H. pylori, of course, if you search for that, but balancing with the patient in front of you. And again, it comes with the age and the effects of eradication, etc. But to make it simple, you should eradicate all the time in this setting.
Yeah, at any stage. Okay. Lovely. That's better. That's good to learn. One of the most important questions that I get when I speak to patients from a patient perspective is what they see and hear in media about proton pump inhibitors and risk of gastric cancer. I think I can see that you made the guideline kind of made some recommendation on that. Can you just clarify what is the stance from the guideline committee about this and how we need to approach this with our patients?
So if the patient truly has an indication to take PPIs, a reflux disease, NSAIDs with a previous history of a peptic ulcer disease. So any reason that you and the patient agree that he should continue to have PPIs, he should be, let's say, less concerned about that in terms of risk of gastric cancer. There is some suggestion that it may lead to, of course, hypochloridia, and also some effect in terms of progression. But that does not, let's say, that should not in any case, and also not only for this, in any case, preclude the fact that patient will have a better quality of life if that's the outcome that we pursue, or a prevention of recurrence of an ulcer in the duodenum. The paradox sometimes is installed because some of these patients are deeply concerned about cancer, but they do smoke, they are overweight, they have other risk factors, and then they are so concerned about PPI. So we need to also use this opportunity to make an holistic approach to this patient and try to convince them to make primary changes that will be, let's say, more consistent with a better health life than only stopping PPI of cancer.
Okay. So the bottom line is to reassure, I guess, and the patients, if there's real good indication, continue and reassure. So, Murray, I've left out the discussion on management dysplasia and early gastric cancer from this because I think that's a very specialist field. We need another hour to discuss that, so we'll leave that out. Thanks for covering all the aspects. And the guidelines have been written so nicely. The charts are amazing. The diagrams are really good. And I do ask the listeners to read that. Although it's 40 pages, it is a good read. Now, what I couldn't understand, or what I found it fascinating, is why maps? Where did this come from?
Thank you for the question. So you challenge the readers to read, and I challenge the readers and the researchers to push and also challenge the guidelines, because we need more evidence to continue to suggest what we suggested or to change what we suggested. So please come with good research. So the MAPS acronym, I think it was, let's say, during a discussion as this one, reading at the title that we were giving to the guideline that goes for management of patients with precancerous conditions in the stomach. So management and precancers and stomach, the S. And it was nicely, let's say, crystallized with MAPS, because it refers to a message that we already alluded during this discussion, that you should map the stomach. You should make an overview of the entire mucosa, and you should take biopsies. So the MAPS goes for the main message of the management of these patients, that is, you should look at the stomach as a whole and make a map.
Yeah. You were involved in most iterations of the MAPS guidelines, is that correct? So how did the journey start with all this?
Yeah, so I dedicated most of my PhD thesis to this topic. And then in 2008, I was elected counselor for ESG. And by chance, Ernst Kuipers, also very much interested in this topic, and also Professor Fatima Carneiro, she is Portuguese, and she was the president of the European Society of Pathology. So there was a coincidence that in the three boards, there were people interested in this topic, that is, even though it's kind of, let's say, gastric cancer is considered to be rare in Europe, you find gastritis and the management of these patients every day in your clinical practice. By coincidence, the fact that we have a network, this is also a nice message, we were able to convince our societies that we could join forces. And then for that first edition, I was the first author. For the second edition, I was honored to be the last. And then this time I became again the first. So let's see how it goes for the next four in 5 years.
The networking is very important, and to change what we do, bring on change. And I'm glad leaders like you exist who take initiative in these things. And I'm very glad that you have spent the last 1.5 hours discussing this with us today. Thanks from the UEG. For everything.
No, thank you for inviting me. And it's an honor and a pleasure always to discuss about this and other topics. So see you soon.
Thanks, Mario. Bye-bye.